you and I and most of the people we know are wealthier than the wealthiest people 100 years ago. Why? Because of oil. Because we can get oil, we can get it cheaply. Now, burning stuff in the ground has other problems, which is that it builds up carbon in the atmosphere. So what we're working on at Terraform is a way of making oil and gas synthetically. So there's no net new carbon going into the atmosphere from the ground. The math and the physics is extremely clear that the cheapest way of getting oil and gas is by synthesizing it using solar power. It might take us another 3 years or 5 years or 10 years, but ultimately it will be cheaper than drilling mile-long holes in the ground and fracking the oil and gas out of them.
G'day, humans. Welcome to the safe space for dangerous ideas. How about a slightly optimistic episode for you if you're doom-scrolling everything else that might be going on in the world? This is a doozy. It's incredible when you talk to someone who has a real, practical, but very wide-ranging vision of what is possible for humankind, what we could do as a human civilization if we just took the tools that we had and actually deployed them, if we overcame our petty squabbles about climate change and energy sources, and if we did away with regulations that were written in the 1970s to impede development. There is now the possibility of using solar arrays, which are now so cheap that you could carpet them across the land and power not only people's electricity in their homes, not only factories, especially if you deployed localized solar arrays on the site of a big factory or a mine or a smelter, but also there is the possibility of using solar energy to extract carbon from the atmosphere and turn it into hydrocarbons, which you can then use in aviation and shipping and in the manufacturing of plastics and all the things that we actually need fossil fuels for. But it would be carbon neutral because the carbon that they produce would then be being sucked up by the process of producing those fossil fuels. It's an incredible field of research, not to mention the fact that artificial intelligence data centers are going to be hoovering up massive amounts of electricity that we are not planning for right now. At the coalface of this, working in California, is the founder and energy entrepreneur of Terraform Industries. This is an Aussie guy. He got his PhD in astrophysics, I think, at Caltech. He's worked for Elon Musk at Hyperloop. He's worked for NASA at the Jet Propulsion Lab in California. And he has a huge brain with incredible ideas. And he's got this startup which seeks to do what I just articulated, turn basically sunlight and air into cheap, abundant hydrocarbons for every man, woman, and child on the planet. I hope your brain is tickled as much as mine was by the one, the only, Casey Handmer.
Well, I just want to make sure that the audience understands just how goddamn handsome Josh is via Riverside. I think it's very important.
It's true. I mean, it's such a shame. It was a tragedy that I was in radio for all the years that I was, because although my voice is also succulent and beautiful and fuckable, it's not as good as this mug you're looking at.
Yeah, exactly. What a waste. Well, thanks to the wonders of the internet, here we are. Okay.
So you were saying you were listening to, before we started this tape, you were saying you were listening to some of my shows, presumably as research for this.
Yeah, because I've been a bit slow on the uptake when it comes to the Australian podcast circuit. Obviously, Joe Walker and I go way back now, but yeah, I was thrilled to get inbound from you and then to go, oh, I've got 5 million back episodes to get through. and of course you've had some real interesting faces on. I'm in my late 30s and I grew up in New South Wales, and so Bob Carr was a fixture of the political establishment when I was kind of coming of age and first starting to read newspapers. And so it was fascinating to have him on. And of course, I've read his memoir, Diary of a Foreign Minister. I was just thinking.
For people who haven't heard that, he was the former Foreign Minister of Australia and the former.
And the Premier of New South Wales.
Most populous state.
Yeah. Between 1995 and 2005, I think. I've never met him personally. He sounds like a very interesting guy.
Glad you know that off the top of your head.
Because I just listened to your podcast.
Yeah. Well, this is great. You're getting all of the information from me that I myself don't know. So this is like a virtual, it's basically a circle jerk where I give you information and then you give it back to me in a mode in which I can actually ingest it.
Yeah.
With two people. Yeah. It's not much of a circle. It's a straight line jerk. That's great. Yeah. Yes. No. So Bob Carr, and I don't know if you heard, but anyway, before we get sidetracked on that, you were saying that you got a bee in your bonnet about submarines from listening to my show.
Yeah, it might not have been the Bob Carr show, but you know, I kind of sat up and took notice when the whole AUKUS thing happened. And of course, I was coming of age.
This is the deal for Australia to pay the UK and the US a fortune for a nuclear submarine collaboration that many defense experts think is foolhardy.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I was not privy to the conversations, but it seems to me at some point a decision was made to retire not just the Collins, but also the Collins class of technology and move towards nuclear power plant for submarines, which is something that I've been incidentally obsessed with for many years. But you know, it's just kind of an interesting question, which is like, you know, Australia is a wealthy country, a technologically advanced country with, you know, rule of law and democracy and so on, and a country of, you know, 25 million people or so. So like, it just kind of right off the top, it's much larger, much richer in natural resources, much richer financially, and much more kind of strategically stable than, say, Taiwan. And yet somehow Taiwan has a stranglehold on the world's supply of the most advanced technology humans even know how to make. And at the same time, Australia is turning around and saying, well, I don't know how we feel about like whether or not absolute national sovereignty should be a policy that we pursue in the 2000s and so on. And to what extent will our kind of defense posture revolve around two kind of fading empires on the other side of the world, which just strikes me as ridiculous, because it's not that hard to build submarines. Yes, it is. It's not easy, but it's not that hard. We already have a functioning submarine design. And the United States built the world's first nuclear-powered submarines in less than 4 years in the 1950s, with less money than the United than Australia currently loses to fraud in its various welfare programs. So it is something that Australia could afford to do, and it's not the sort of thing where we need to kind of wait 5 or 10 or 15 years to get to the front of the queue on the Virginia class fast attack submarine if we so choose. So You know, I'm an Australian American now. I'm an American citizen too. But I think that peace is assured when potential belligerents have to think twice, right? And I think that John Howard was absolutely correct, the former Prime Minister of Australia, when he said that during the kind of conflict that occurred over the separation of East Timor from Indonesia in about 1996, the fact that Australia had the F-111s, which were, you know, supersonic capable heavy bombers, was determinative. In his view, I think, and I may be misattributing this, to there not being an expansion of that conflict, which for a hot minute there looked like it was going to turn very, very hot. And so yeah, I think, like, you know, Australians are wealthy, peace-loving people, and we absolutely can afford to peel off a few billion a year to make sure that we can remain that way forever. And that, you know,
I mean, I suppose that isn't the fear that it wouldn't end up costing a couple of billion dollars a year, that there are all kinds of regulatory and political reasons why the cost would blow out and it would end up being a white elephant, and that's what all the politicians fear, so they don't have the courage to do it?
Yeah, I think that that's probably the most likely outcome, but it's by no means guaranteed, right? And I think if you say that's the most likely outcome, it's also kind of conceding that the most likely outcome is that Australia ends up as a protectorate of a more powerful Asian-based power. And you know, I think, you know, we ran that flag up the flagpole in 1939 and decided, no, actually, we'd rather not. And the diggers went and defended Australian territorial integrity and sovereignty in Kokoda, amongst other places, and fought with a bare fraction of what we could even imagine. I mean, like, I can walk down to the local Walmart here in Los Angeles and buy more weaponry than they had available to them in that battle on either side.
Godless America.
But, you know, it's literally just down the road here. I can go and buy, you know, absolute treasure trove of weapons. And I think that, that, you know, Australia should be damn serious about making sure that, you know, we don't have to go and build a fleet of aircraft carriers to fight yesterday's war, but we do need to make sure that we're, you know, positioned to oppose the sort of thing that has destroyed the lives of so many Ukrainians, for example, in the last few years.
Sorry to interrupt, Casey, but don't you think that the rationale for, and without, we won't get bogged down in defense for too long because there's so much that I want to pick your brain about.
Yeah, I don't really know anything about it.
But don't you, you're so knowledgeable of such a wide range of areas. We're talking about the one thing on which we're both amateurs, but it is interesting. It might've been Sam Roggeveen's chat that got you angry about AUKUS. I don't know. Do you know Sam?
No, I haven't listened to that one, but podcast. I can get angry about it.
Listen to that. Get angry about that, because he's anti-AUKUS, and he's written a book called the echidna strategy, saying that Australia's defence should lie in being like an echidna, which is sort of like an Australian kind of hedgehog, you know, prickly on the outside, but sort of squishy and inoffensive on the middle. What the defenders of the AUKUS of a nuclear alliance with the United States and the UK would say that being a protectorate of a big Asian power is precisely what that is trying to avoid, and that the only reason why Taiwan isn't safe only because of semiconductors. Taiwan is safe because of the supposed promise that America has, or the strategic ambiguity that America has, that it would defend Taiwan. So isn't Australia just sort of pursuing the same strategy? Have big powerful friends?
Well, I mean, Australia is not currently, like, it's not currently the policy of the CCP that Australia is a renegade province.
No, this is fortunate.
Well, yeah, but I mean, you know, opinions can vary. The Japanese minted a special currency just for Australia after they conquered Australia, right? And enslaved Australia's populace, as they had done to the rest of Southeast Asia. I bet that would have been real fun.
In World War II.
In World War II.
Just to clarify for people, the Japanese got all the way down to, you know, right around Australia. And that
they bombarded Sydney.
The full intention of taking. Yeah. And certainly, and they had submarines in Sydney Harbour. But I mean, they had actually successfully occupied basically the entire swathe of Asia all around, right up to the edge of Australia.
Yeah, all the way through the Solomon.
And Australia was the next step. Yeah.
Did not go so well for them in the end. But the point I'm trying to say is, in the grand scheme of things, having an unanswerable defense posture with, you know, combination of drones, aircraft, submarines, and other kind of very hard to kill targets is exactly what we need in echidna. It's like, yes, we're very friendly and we're very cute and we look great on a 5-cent piece, and don't fuck us.
Yeah.
Right.
Or you can fuck badly. Us, just don't fuck with us. Yeah. Only gently.
The echidna only consensual. Not like that. Yeah. I think it's really important. And I know plenty of Chinese people. You know, do they want their sons and daughters to go and die in a war against the Yanks and against Australians? Of course not. Right? They're not crazy. They just want to get rich like anyone else. Mm. So really, it just comes down to convincing a handful of like old, nearly dead men that like, just take the W and like get on with life. And the way you do that is by saying, okay, we'll peel a couple of billion off the top each year and just make sure that like we look like a hard target. But like right now, right, like Australia, like it's not that hard to build a nuclear submarine for the second time, right? Brazil is in the process of building a nuclear submarine right now. Brazil, right? And like they build aircraft and stuff. They're no slouches technologically in this large country, but like they're nowhere near as wealthy as Australia is, right? Australia is as wealthy as the United States was when the United States built the first nuclear submarines. And we had to figure out in the United States how to do it for the first time from scratch. Like no one had ever built a nuclear power reactor before. They built the first one and they stuck it in a goddamn submarine and then drove it around for a while. Like, actually, submarines still exist. So it's not that hard. And anyone who says, oh, well, it's going to take 15 years and $11 trillion isn't serious. Because if that's the case, then how the hell did Rickover manage to build one in 1,000 days from scratch?
Right. I mean, when you say we're as rich as the United States was in the 50s, you mean the entire country probably has the same GDP as the United States did in the 50s. Because per capita, we must be way richer than the
GDP per capita. Yeah, on a per capita basis.
Well, we must be richer than Americans were in the 50s.
On a per capita basis, yes. But at the same time, you know, the United States is doing a lot of different things in the 50s.
It's also possible that the Australian economy today is as large as the US economy was in the 50s.
I doubt it. Maybe someone can write in.
But yes, write in. They only probably had 100 million, 150 million people, and they were probably a third as wealthy as modern people are. I mean, I wouldn't be that surprised. Anyway, it's probably ballpark, and it's certainly something that we could do. Okay, I need on-hold music here. I need, like, the Jeopardy music.
$4.2 trillion, nominal GDP, 1950 in the United States. So I think that's somewhat larger than the Australian economy today.
Google the Australian GDP in US dollars.
$1.75 trillion.
Okay, a little more than twice.
Small.
Yep.
Yeah, but even so, like, it's kind of immaterial. Because the United States turned around, and they went and built hundreds of fast attack submarines, nuclear, and then they built the boomers. And then they built nuclear aircraft carriers and nuclear destroyers. And then they built ICBMs and steerable nuclear weapons on top of that. So like Australia does not have to do all that. We just have to have an unanswerable,
that's right.
You will not be able to blockade our ports. right? Like, or you might not be able to blockade our ports.
Yeah. We also don't even need, I mean, Casey, we don't even need nuclear weapons. I mean, if the sticking point is, oh, we don't have experience in building nuclear stuff, which is also not true because we do have a couple of nuclear reactors here to produce medical devices. Yeah, yeah. But if that is the sticking point, you only need nuclear submarines if you want to go a long, long way away on these very, very long voyages, which might take you up to Taiwan or whatever. If you want to just defend the Australian mainland, then you can just build a whole bunch of conventional submarines and drones and stuff, and that's more than adequate, and we certainly know how to do that.
In practice, you have to have the ability to patrol the Straits of Malacca, right? If you're going to be a meaningful part of a regional defense initiative against, let's say, East Asian adversaries. But yeah, I mean...
Right.
Whatever, I'm one of these people who says nuclear power is great. I used to teach nuclear physics at Caltech, but nuclear reactors are only really useful for submarines. Right? So the one thing that they're the killer app for is submarines. and they're a bargain for that application, right? Like the fact that you can go out and buy a Virginia class fast attack submarine for $1.7 billion is like, what a bargain! Like absurdly advanced piece of technology, and what it allows you to do, and the difference it makes. It would be much better to be like, oh, well, we built all these submarines and we ran them for years and it turns out we didn't need them. What a waste of money. Like, that is such a better situation than like, oh, well, we're now finding ourselves in the same position as the colonized people that live in Western China, right?
Mm.
Who like live in camps and assemble stuff under conditions of slave labor and are not allowed to have children. You know, like, anyway.
I'm voting against that option. I don't want that for my kids.
Our children would hate us.
Right? Yes, our children would. It terrifies me anyway that the AUKUS deal relies on a future US administration. Like, they have the total right to withdraw from the deal for any reason and keep the money that we've already paid and not give us the submarines if for any reason they think that US security needs those
absolutely.
Submarines. And their capacity of building is also glacially slow in comparison to their own needs, let alone ours. It's entirely possible that
the American shipyards are also in deep trouble. Same problem.
Yeah, it's entirely possible that we'll just end up with nothing and we'll completely undefended between 2030 and until we get our shit together.
Well, that's the thing. And if you said, okay, we've got these shipyards in South Australia and we've got a able and well-trained workforce and we have the ability to print money, like, let's go and start building our own system. Then yeah, you could have, like, if it took Hyman Rickover and his team less than 4 years to do it for the first time ever in 1950. Like, you could say, do it in 4 years. And I don't see why it couldn't be done in 4 years. I'm just saying, like, in principle, like, the technology is already understood. You probably buy a secondhand one off the Russians if you ask nicely. I mean, like, somehow the Soviets figured out how to build this, and the Soviet GDP at the time was minuscule, right? Absolutely minuscule. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, forget it in our comparison about the Australian versus US GDP, even though we have 1/15 the population back in 1950, the Australian GDP and the Russian GDP, I think Australia's economy is bigger than Russia's, or it's about the same. There's another one for you to Google. What's the Australian?
Okay, it was launched in 1957. Okay, so what was the size of the size of Soviet economy in 1957? It's probably hard to estimate because it was a control command economy. $400 billion.
Wow.
So a fifth of the size of Australia's economy today.
That's probably the economy of Sydney.
Or maybe New South Wales or something. But yeah, I spent a bit of time in Russia when I was a younger man. And like, that was 20 years ago now, 15 years. But like, it's really, in some ways, it's the place that time forgot. Like, large sections of the country are still as poor as they were in 1908. But it's absolutely astonishingly deprived place. Okay.
Mm.
Enough about submarines.
Incidentally, what are you using to do your research when you're looking up those numbers?
I was just Googling it. So probably Gemini was throwing some numbers in.
Oh.
But yeah.
Yeah. Okay. All right. I thought you might have some highly sophisticated AI that you use for purely data purposes.
As opposed to some second tier system like Gemini.
yeah, exactly. Some bullshit. Whatever Google can throw up at you out of the dregs of the internet. You said something a moment ago that some people will have raised their eyebrows at, which is that when you were teaching nuclear physics at was it Caltech or MIT?
Yeah, Caltech.
At Caltech, the only good use of nuclear technology is in a submarine. A lot of people who are worried about the climate think that you're always going to need baseload power from nuclear or coal or something like that, in spite of solar. This is something you firmly disagree with. Why do we not need, are we misunderstanding something about the concept of baseload power?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's lots of different tribes and they all have their favorite method of powering stuff. No, and I think if you want to look at an economy that went all in on nuclear, you could look at the French economy, right? And the French have obviously valued strategic independence from the United States since the mid-1950s as well. And they've got their own nuclear submarines and nuclear missiles because they haven't taken any more chances, I'll put it that way, as Australia shouldn't. But, you know, their economy is largely powered by nuclear power. And as a result, like, they're going great in Europe right now by comparison to the other countries that don't have that energy. But at the same time, they're not well positioned to ride the wave of cheap power from solar. And actually, you don't have to take my word for it. You can just look at the scoreboard, right? So currently, like, global solar PV manufacturing capacity is about 1.4 terawatts per year, which is, all things being equal, like, about the same size as the global nuclear fleet, once you take into account utilization factors.
So fleet meaning all nuclear power or just nuclear submarine fleet?
Oh, no, all nuclear power.
All nuclear power and all solar is about the same, you're saying?
Yeah, so it's about 460 gigawatts globally of nuclear. And the global solar fleet is much larger than that now, and it's growing by more than that every year. Like, so it's the market, in its infinite wisdom, has decided that solar is where it's getting its future electrons from. I read today that Europe gets more power from wind and solar than from fossil sources. California now gets most of its power more of its power from solar than any other source. And obviously China is building everything it can get its hands on, but solar is definitely winning in China as well.
Right, but I mean, that just shows us the direction that we're going in from a fossil fuel-based economy. I'm sort of asking about the question that the criticism of that. So yes, there may be an enormous amount of unused capacity of solar, right? But once you get up to, I don't know, 80% solar, then you've still got this problem of what happens when the sun doesn't shine and the wind doesn't blow. You're always going to have those moments where there's peak power. Everyone gets home at 5 p.m. on a hot day, turns on their air conditioning or whatever. And
the sun is famously unreliable. Sometimes, if biblical accounts are to be believed, it just doesn't shine. this problem is solved. It's batteries. It's always batteries. People say, well, you know, are you telling me that in the future, every man, woman, and child in the United States is going to have, like, the equivalent of an entire kilogram of lithium-ion battery all to themselves? That's unimaginable. But if you'd spoken to people in 1995, that's what they would have said, because back then, lithium-ion batteries were an elite product for high performance handycams. But nowadays, you know, just in my family, we have multiple electric cars and Powerwalls and things like that. So, like, you just say, well, you look to the future and you draw the line on the graph and you say, well, yeah, there'll be a time when the per capita allocation of lithium ion battery is about a ton per person and no one has any shortage at all. And I mean, am I losing sleep at night worrying that, like, the rechargeable lithium ion battery pack that I have on my toy drone isn't being fully utilized at all times? No. Don't even care, right? These are commoditized products. The price per pack of lithium ion and sodium ion batteries has fallen by 60% in the last 24 months. Just read that yesterday. So back when I was a young engineer a few years ago, probably 10 years ago now, batteries are coming down by about 5% per year in terms of price. And we're like, well, I'll take 5% per year. That's pretty good. In terms of, like, free improvement, thanks to the market. But now it's more like 20%, 30% per year. So it's, we're hitting the big leagues.
Is there any engineering limit or resources limit in terms of rare earths or anything like that on flooding every man, woman, and child in the world with massive battery capacity indefinitely?
Not compared to, like, hafnium and vanadium supplies for nuclear power plants or something like that. No. Lithium is the third most common element in the universe. Solar panels made of silicon, which is the second most common element in the Earth's crust after oxygen. There's no shortage. Like, you could say, well, you know, a solar panel is, I don't know, like the thickness of a sheet of paper or something like that, the thickness of two sheets of paper. Okay. Is there enough silicon on Earth to make that? Well, the entire crust of the Earth is made of silicon.
It's a lot of sheets of paper.
100 kilometers of rock under your feet. And then under that, you've got another 1,000 kilometers of, like, silicate-rich, gooey mantle rock, right? There's no shortage. Don't worry. We'll be able to pave the entire world with solar before we even think about running out. And actually, that's kind of the scary outcome. Because it seems to me that actually the downside is not, oh no, what about baseload, which is just a made up thing, right? It's like, oh, well, what if we build these AIs that, like, generate 1,000 times more GDP per acre of land that's under solar panels than we derive from eating, like, food that's grown on the same land, right? Do we have a plan to avoid having, like, the marginal acre of farmland being converted to to solar to feed the AIs. And I don't think this is a problem that's likely to occur in the next 5 years, but we may want to think about this in the context of like long-term land usage on the surface of the earth. Just to be clear, we can supply the entirety of human civilization with US levels of fossil fuel profligacy using synthetic fuels like what we're doing at Terraform without changing surface land use at all, really. Like we'll probably take a bunch of corn ethanol land out of production and actually net reduce the amount of land that humans are using. But if you want to power an AI-based economy with a billion times more GDP than we currently have, then it's going to be a very different looking Earth.
Right. And I mean, I presume that what you're saying is that if the profit that can be generated from a square mile of land that is covered in solar panels, which is powering AI, is massively more than the amount of money that people can get from farming that land, then either we're going to have food shortages or food's going to be very, very expensive.
Well, it's the same thing. I mean, they say there's no such thing as shortages under capitalism. The price just, you know, reflects the balance between supply and demand. Yeah, which is not a... Yeah, it's a difficult situation, potentially.
Just paint out this vision for us, because for a lot of people that were hearing it for the first time and scratching their heads a little bit about thinking about that amount of land devoted to solar panels, and a lot of people will be thinking, well, obviously that's not going to happen. We don't have that much land. Where is it all going to go? Why do solar panels really need that much space? How much energy are we talking about these AIs actually hoovering up? Can you just sort of take us step by step through from here to the scenario in which AI is that energy hungry that our solution is to turn Nevada into one giant solar panel?
Well, now I'm getting excited.
I know you have a fetish for coating Nevada in solar panels.
Just to kind of paint you into the picture here, something like 29% of Earth's surface area is land, the rest being ocean. And of the land area, about 1% is like significantly modified by humans, like urbanized, essentially. So if you live in Sydney or Los Angeles or New York, you'd be used to kind of just seeing the seething urban hordes. But if you ever make the mistake of looking out the window while flying from Los Angeles to pretty much anywhere, you'd be like, oh, wow, there's a bunch of desert out the window. And then an hour later, wow, there's still desert out the window. And like, no one lives there. And you could just like...
Yeah, I mean, try flying from Sydney to... I just got back from Bali 2 days ago, Casey.
Oh, same,
I flew
same story.
Over yeah, Australia beautiful. from Broome to Sydney. You leave Bali and in an hour and a half you hit the Australian coastline, and the remaining 6 hours of the flight is nothing. Is just nothing. From essentially, it's like to an American, it's like flying from Portland to Miami, basically, but there's nothing in between.
Yeah. You could throw fistfuls of ball bearings out the window the whole way, right? And you'd never hit anyone. Right? Never hit anything at all. It'd usually be considered very inadvisable to like throw fistfuls of ball bearings off top of a tall building or something, right? but you could be very responsible about it on an airplane on this route, and you'd never hit anyone. There's plenty of land. And then something like 20% of Earth's land surface area is devoted to farming, of which about 3/4 is pasture and the rest is row crops, and maybe another 20% to forestry. About 30% of Earth's land surface area is uninhabited deserts, and about another 10% is mountainous or swamps. So like something like half of Earth's land surface area is currently like almost no one lives there. Almost no one lives there, unless it happens to be like a lot of oil there or something like that. But even then, like the population of, say, the UAE or something is still small on a global scale. And don't get me wrong, one day I would love to irrigate these places and make them much more habitable for humans. It's mostly about a water shortage rather than a temperature thing. But almost no one lives there. And so you can have this situation where you can provide all the power that all our cities need with just rooftop solar and parking lot top solar. So it's just enough. There's enough solar to provide all the power that the city currently uses. That's mostly for air conditioning in summer and heating in winter, with some batteries to handle the evening peak. There's a fellow who's been doing daily simulations on the Australian grid for going on 6 years now that basically shows that you can quite easily do this. Then for synthetic fuels, if you want to have the ability to fly like supersonically, you know, across oceans and stuff like that, you need quite a bit more energy. It's about a 10x increase. So you end up taking, you know, a couple, maybe 2 or 3 or 4% in total of Earth's land surface area, which is like, you know, the areas outside cities, and putting that under solar. And then that provides all the energy you need for synthetic fuels, and you're done. Right.
Let me just pause there, because some people will be hearing the word synthetic fuels for the first time.
The point
is that, you know, a battery might be all very well to air condition your house, but the power that a 777 needs to get off the runway and fly from Sydney to Los Angeles is too much for a battery to plausibly, pull off. So you still need something like aviation fuel. And what you're saying is you don't have to dig that out of the ground. You can take the sun's energy and you can just make a synthetic or artificial concentrate that performs the same way as
well. You just make it's exactly the same, right? Or arguably slightly better. And most likely, I think high performance future aviation will use liquefied natural gas, which is the same fuel that SpaceX uses in their Starship as the fuel. LNG, it's a, you know, we send it out in ships across the world these days. And it's higher mass density than like energy density per mass than kerosene, regular jet fuel. And it's cryogenic, which can be helpful for cooling at extreme speeds. But yeah.
Can you make liquefied natural gas synthetically, or is that always?
Yeah, for sure. That's actually the easiest thing to make. So we're working on natural gas here at Terraform. We're working on liquids as well, but it's a little harder to do. Anyway, this is kind of besides the point. The problem with aviation is like people don't have a very good conception for just how much fuel goes in airplanes and how thirsty they are. So if I'm flying to Sydney from Los Angeles, which is about a 12-hour flight, my seat's consumption of fuel, right? There's like, I don't know, 400 people on the airplane. My personal consumption of fuel on that flight is like 500 liters. It's like 1,000 pounds of fuel. It is an absolutely absurd amount of fuel. Like I could drive a Hummer and it would make almost no difference. If I fly back and forth to Australia a couple of times a year, I could drive a Prius or a Hummer. Makes no difference. So just for reference, that's like 5 or 6 bathtubs worth full to the brim of kerosene just to get my sorry ass one way across the Pacific Ocean. It's what a fabulous material kerosene is that allows you to do that, right? That you sit in moderate comfort in an air-conditioned cabin on the edge of the atmosphere, flying at almost the speed of sound across the ocean that spans half a planet. For a measly 12 hours, and bam, you're in Sydney.
Just as an aside on this, Casey, because I was talking to my kids about it when we were on the plane, I was explaining to them that the wings are full of fuel, that they store the fuel mainly in the wings and then under the where the wings meet the belly. And I was explaining that I can't remember the statistics, so I'm sure I'll get it wrong, but it's something like when the plane is taking off, when a fully laden 777 or 747 or A380 is taking off, it's something like 14 garden hoses on full blast of fuel that are being burned constantly.
It might be.
Like just imagine a garden hose turning it on. It was like 8 or 4, but it's that amount of fuel.
Yeah, it's like half the weight of the plane for these take off.
Yeah, and the challenge for these ultra long flights, I'm a bit of a plane nerd, as regular listeners will know, and Qantas is launching these ridiculous flights later this year, which are going to be the first time that Sydney is connected nonstop to London and to New York. And the reason they have to get Airbus to build an entirely new plane for them. Well, a modified A350, but it's an entirely new version specifically just for the Australian airline because they're the only ones crazy enough to think that there's a market for people to pay a premium for this.
Well, it's the only place where there are rich people at the end of the world.
That's true. The only place where there are rich people at the end of the world. There you go. And the challenge is that once you get up to a 12, 13, 14, 15-hour flight, maybe 16-hour flight, maybe 17-hour flight, the fuel that the plane's going to be using in the final hour of the flight has to be carried all the way until it gets to be needed. And there becomes this incremental point where after about like 15 hours, it's just not worth it to be adding an extra hour's worth of fuel because you then need to add more fuel in order to carry the weight of the extra fuel that you're going to need. So these are going to be 22-hour flights nonstop. And all of those, that final hour of fuel, they have to then load a whole bunch of more fuel on in order to carry the final hour's fuel for 21 hours.
Yeah,
it's
a rocket equation. It's the same reason you need to stage rockets when you launch to space.
Right.
Well, the rockets have to bring their oxidizer as well, so it's even worse. Yeah, I mean, it's just the nature of the beast. There's no two ways about it. I mean, you could design an airplane that can fly all the way without having to fly low and slow. Or you can just fly really slowly, right? You can save that fuel by adding another 3 or 4 hours to the flight. It just doesn't the economics aren't the economics say like just add another fuel tank and be happy about it. I mean it's kind of a neat trick. You can fly. There's a crazy guy just up the road here many years ago who built a couple of airplanes that flew all the way around the world on a single tank of gas. the whole way around.
Right, but I mean, what was the weight of the plane? I mean, he wasn't carrying.
It was a small plane, but it was about 80% fuel on takeoff. Yeah, like an eggshell.
Yeah, right.
Two desperados flying for 3 days nonstop, and beautiful aircraft. It's in the Smithsonian, the Rutan.
I love it.
It can be done, and of course, I'm very excited about supersonic aviation. So instead of taking 22 hours to fly slowly to New York or to London, you could take, you know, maybe 8 hours to fly with one stop in between the whole way.
Mm.
So you don't even get jet lag.
Just before we leave supersonic, can you get around the sonic boom for the people on the ground as you fly over them?
Yeah, I mean, part of the answer to that is that most of the world has no one on it at all because it's ocean, right? And most of the land doesn't have very many people on it either. And so like that doesn't really matter all that much. And then you can kind of play some games around speed and shape of the wing and so on to reduce the boom. And then I think for the rest, you just say, wow, sonic boom, that's so cool. Right? One of the major problems of building modern supersonic aircraft is actually not the noise of the boom. It's the noise of the jets on takeoff. So I don't know if you ever saw Concorde. I saw Concorde flying in and out of Sydney a few times when I was a kid. It was loud, right? It was loud. And under modern, like, you know, airport noise regulations, you couldn't build and certify a Concorde. So that's right, actually the challenge. Right. So you end up in this situation where like the performance of your aircraft is compromised by like, oh no, you can't be too noisy for the, I don't know, seagulls that live at the end of the airport. Like, come on.
I assume it's for the old ladies who are living at the end of the airport runway in apartments.
But, I just give them a free flight once a year. Fact, be like, this is so cool.
It's true. It's okay. True. Yes. So solar panels coating Nevada in order to fuel our AI overlords.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's the obvious place to put them, right? Because the AIs don't care if they live in the desert, whereas humans mostly prefer not to. And they can talk to us at the speed of light with optical fibers or Starlink. So it makes sense to kind of put them in the places people don't want to live. And now SpaceX actually just announced that they've merged with XAI. So they're going to be building massive data centers in space, which is, you know, another kind of move in that direction.
And just to clarify, you would build a data center in space so that the solar power doesn't have to go through the atmosphere and is more powerful, or why?
Yeah, the solar resource is a bit better in space. Is it as good compared to like the difference in shipping costs? No. Rockets are really expensive compared to trucking something in the middle of nowhere and plugging it in. But if you are a company like SpaceX and you are already sitting on a kind of massive launch capability that's set to expand further, and your like first pass at what's a like, you know, kind of infinite demand solution for infinite launch that we can launch and create money with, which is Starlink, and you're already looking at saturating demand for Starlink, which they're not quite there yet, but Starship their giant rocket will do that pretty quickly. You need something else which can basically slurp up solar power in space and convert it into high value data that you can then send back to Earth with microwaves. And it turns out that you know, while internet data is pretty valuable, you can charge enough money that SpaceX is on track to make over $10 billion of revenue this year. AI tokens are probably about 1,000 times more valuable. And so it's a very interesting business, right? Because you don't want to end up in a situation where you spend $10 billion building a gigantic rocket and then no one is available to fly on it, right? No one wants to fly on it. So you've got to make sure that you've got both sides of this business ready to go. So I think that's the main push there.
I don't quite get it, Casey, because why wouldn't you isn't the fuel that you need to get it into space more expensive than if you just put a lot of
batteries on the ground or something?
Like, yeah, have a data center.
Probably, yeah.
Have the data center and the batteries on the ground and then just fire it via the internet into space and then back down via Starlink. What do you gain by placing the data center in space?
So you can say, why don't I just take one of these fancy Starlink data centers and I'll just put it on the ground and hook up a battery so it can work at night. Wouldn't that be cheaper? And the answer is yes. It would probably be about twice as cheap in terms of the dollar cost per AI token generated. But the margins on these tokens are high enough because they're so valuable that it's not actually a marginal business. Like the profit margins for the companies that are serving these tokens on a kind of operational basis are very, very high. So as long as SpaceX can make money, they don't have to make quite as much money as they would operating on the ground, then they completely delete the downside of you know, leveling up this massive, you know, 10,000, 100,000 ton to orbit per year capacity on the launch side and having nowhere to go with that. I think that's the strategy, but I don't know. I don't have internal capability or internal knowledge about.
No, but
about
I mean, you're touching there on something that I want to chat to you about, which is counterintuitive for a lot of people and was for me until I came across your work, which is that when you think about the incredible demand on energy that artificial intelligence is going to have, that data centers are going to have, the problem is actually not the cost of energy. I mean, the cost of energy matters to you and me. It matters because we want people to be able to afford to heat their homes and whatnot. But that once you get up to a hyperscale, the limitation that these systems are not power cost sensitive. They're sensitive to the availability of power, but not the cost of power. Can you unpack that?
I don't know. I mean, I think this is fairly intuitively obvious to people who understand that, like, the Google is not going out of business by giving their employees free food, right? Right. Like, the economic value generated by Google's employees is far, far higher than the cost of the food that they're giving them, right? And it's kind of the same situation with the AI data centers, right? You might pay $100 a month for your Claude subscription, right? But how much does Anthropic spend on power to pay for those tokens it uses? It's probably like 10 cents. It's probably like 1,000 to 1, right? And most of their costs.
And just to clarify for GPUs. People, if they don't know what a token is, you're talking about tokens, but tokens are the things that AI uses to generate AI. So think of it like a piece of
Just think of it like a letter, right? in an AI software. Response or something, right? So that's what you get billed on, right? It's the amount of bytes that come shooting out the end of that infernal computer. So most of what the hyperscalers are paying for is the GPUs, right? It's NVIDIA and TSMC building these incredible computers that are able to obviously consume power and then replicate some vestiges of human thought. Yeah, so that's kind of the idea there.
But just unpack it for me, because I think what was interesting to me about it was that if I'm paying like $30 a month for ChatGPT, then the marginal cost to ChatGPT of my being a participant in what they're doing, of my consumption, is negligible once they've already bought the computers.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, there's economies of scale.
Yeah, the value that I get out of having access to artificial intelligence is a lot more than what they currently charge me. I would have a price point that's considerably higher than I currently pay for it.
Mm-hmm.
And so if they need to charge me a little bit more because the fraction of their costs that energy comprises, even if that doubled, it's still a small fraction of their input costs. And so in terms of the overall value of the output that they're generating, when people think about the skyrocketing challenges of providing enough electricity cheaply enough for artificial intelligence to get to the next level, it's not actually a problem of cost, because electricity could triple, quadruple, quintuple, 10x in cost, and it wouldn't be a major difference to their inputs and what, even if they had to charge me a little bit more.
Not a major problem for them as end users. One other advantage of operating in space is the regulatory, on the regulatory side. Yeah, I mean, like, getting permission to fly satellites in space is non-trivial, but SpaceX is pretty good at it. And once they've done it, they can just copy paste all day long, right? So they've already submitted applications to launch these new generation of satellites in space. Whereas on the ground, it's technically easier to truck like a truckload of solar panels over there. But like, how many different regulatory jurisdictions do you have to deal with just to copy paste this across Nevada? It's like dozens and dozens. The United States in general is thousands. Globally, it's probably in the hundreds of thousands of separate regulatory jurisdictions just to put solar panels on the ground. It's kind of insane. And then the power cost is not that important for these AI companies. And actually, the power generation costs in general are not that high. Part of the reason that the consumers are being squeezed at the in terms of their power, what they pay for their power bills, is because it's actually the cost of delivering power from a power plant somewhere to the house that is, the transmission and distribution, where there's no competition, there's no effective regulation, and Balmoral's cost disease is biting real hard. And so you're seeing this absolutely harrowing stories of people on fixed incomes basically losing the ability to heat their homes and turn on their lights because the regulatory apparatus has failed them, right? It's failed to ensure that the supply is expanding faster than demand to keep the prices low. We see this all around the world. It really blows my mind. Germany, as recently as 6 months ago, patting themselves on the back for having successfully, shut down all the nuclear power plants. But suicide, absolutely stupid, unbelievable. But the same story is happening pretty much everywhere in the West, where people are congratulating themselves that they're getting major energy development infrastructure cancelled or pushed away. Like, it's absolutely crazy. You can't complain and then complain about high gas prices.
But the right wingers who I know, I mean, I had Tony Abbott, the former prime minister, on the show, and his attitude towards energy and climate is similar to many of colleagues who I find frustrating to talk to on the sort of right-wing heterodox side of podcasterstan, which is that the reason why there's been this regulatory neglect of abundant energy is precisely because everybody's got obsessed with this whole net zero climate change scam and has become leery about. And they basically frame it as a trade-off between our prosperity and abundance on the one hand versus us eking out an impoverished existence with high energy prices and old ladies freezing to death in London because we've been ideologically hoodwinked into shooting ourselves in the foot. Even if climate change is real, China and all these other countries aren't doing enough.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think there's this false binary that's set up that it sounds like that I don't want you to be misunderstood as playing into. What are the regulatory impediments that have created the shitstorm that we currently enjoy in terms of energy, if not ones that are motivated largely by an obsession with net zero and carbon?
Yeah, I mean, I listened to Tony Abbott's show with you as well, and I think he's absolutely spot on when he says getting poor is not the way to improve our climate, resiliency in the future. We actually need to stay rich. And I think he's absolutely correct that you don't want to go around prematurely shutting down existing energy generation infrastructure that's fully paid off until you've got the next thing lined up. Where I think he's wrong is he's like a lot of older fellows, I think a little anchored in the past when it comes to, the real world development and progress we've seen on these other technologies. So my answer to this is just all of the above. Build the solar arrays, build the wind turbines, build the batteries. It's mostly solar and batteries, really. Increase supply, right? It'll be very, very clear when it's time to turn off Liddell or any other coal or gas power plant because they don't want to make
money. It's a coal-fired power plant. Yeah, but don't prematurely go around shutting down coal-fired power
plants. Yeah, and leave the nuclear power plants on. Like, shutting down nuclear power plants is such a scam, right? And again, I'm just going to high-five the third rail all around here, right? Why is it a scam? Well, it's kind of it's a scam in three parts. The first scam is, first of all, we'll have this fairly stringent regulatory regime that makes it extremely difficult to build nuclear power plants cheaply, right? We've just seen this firsthand in the United States where they finished two plants in Georgia, I think, after like almost 20 years of development. Multiple people involved in the procurement went to prison. Like, that's how corrupt it was. And vastly over budget and vastly behind schedule. Okay. And then once you've built the damn thing, now you've got the nuclear industry. This is something that Hyman Rickover himself fought throughout his life, although he died in 1985. The nuclear industry itself is constantly engaged in rent-seeking operations to try and force through new regulatory measures that, A, makes it harder for new entrants to compete, and, B, mandates that their operators and their customers continually spring for taxpayer-funded upgrades and stuff that aren't really needed, right? That just kind of increase the complexity of the plan, increase its cost, make it harder and more expensive to maintain over time. And for the third act, you get the same people turn around and say, oh, well, now it's time to shut down the plant, so we'll... they've been caught red-handed, actively participating in these anti-nuclear advocacy programs. The very same people who are making money maintaining them, advocating through third parties to shut them down. Why? Because what's better than getting like infinite money and infinite time to build a nuclear power plant? Getting infinite time and infinite money to pull one apart. Because at the end, you don't even have to have a nuclear power plant that works. Right, we've seen this in Germany, right? Where the like Siemens and I don't know which companies are totally involved, like basically the major European contractors, engineering contractors that do these things, commence these operations. They've got a half disassembled nuclear power plant with the wind blowing gently by, and they're like, "Oh, well, it'd be an awful shame if we were to lose containment on the core." Next thing you're spending 10 times as much pulling an old nuclear power plant apart as you'd spend building a new one. And at the end of the day, what do you got to show for it? No nuclear power plant, no nuclear industry. No handy store of plutonium, just in case things get hot with the Russians. What a disaster, right? I don't think that we should be building new nuclear power plants at this point, but there's also no reason to shut them down until they're actually genuinely at the end of their life. And these are things that, like airplanes, for example, if you maintain them well, they will last forever. That's kind of, especially if you're in a situation where like you've got colder winters and you don't have your own adequately developed supplies of gas and oil. Right, absolutely crazy.
So is it the same engineering companies that build nuclear power plants that disassemble nuclear power plants? So they have a vested interest in earning a lot of money from disassembling the thing that they just built.
Well, it's not that they just built, right? But it'll say, let's say you're
30 years ago.
Yeah, cozy oligopoly of like two or three kind of heavily intertwined large engineering contractors that operate in, say, a particular place like France or Germany or some other European country, right? Like, you're looking around, you're like, okay, well, how are we going to increase our revenue and our profit this quarter and this year and next year, right? On a given fixed fleet of nuclear power plants, right? Like, once you've built out your nuclear fleet, there's not a whole lot to do with them. And this is kind of part of the pickle with these monopoly concessions, which is, yeah. all of these power companies are monopolistic. They're legal monopolies, but it also means that they're not particularly dynamic. And as we've seen, not particularly well positioned to take advantage of improvements in technology and to pass price savings down to their customers. And really, like, unfortunately, I'm very kind of black-pilled about this. I don't think it's likely to change, right? I don't think that we've ever seen, like, you know, PJM or the Tennessee Valley Authority or SoCalGas or PG&E, like, really read the Riot Act on this front and improve their game. What we see instead is what we've, like, probably the best case what we've seen is in Australia, where we've massively deregulated and streamlined the process for building rooftop solar and residential battery supplies to the point where there's higher penetration in Australia than almost any other country. And people, you know, the response to the feed-in tariffs being brought down and eventually turned negative is that people are genuinely just islanding from the grid, just turning off, right? Which talk about like a massive own goal on the part of the regulatory authorities and the incumbent power providers. But like, what do they expect was going to happen? Like, the future is solar and batteries. So either you do that and you sell it to people at a reasonable price, like Netflix or Napster or Spotify or whatever, or they will do it themselves, you know, in some form of like semi-legal piracy, and you will not be able to do anything about it because for all our modern state police powers and so on, no one has yet been able to successfully force people to turn lights on and off when they want them to.
Casey, just on the question of nuclear and Europe and France and Germany, whenever we talk about energy and Europe, I mean, a couple of things come up. One is, a lot of Europe is cloudy and cold and dark for 6 months of the year. Another is, when Russia invaded Ukraine, would it have been possible for the Europeans to flick a switch and gain total energy independence without the kind of problems that they've seen lately in their energy supply? What could they have done?
Well, if we're doing counterfactuals, I do seem to remember reading last week that Germany and the European Union have announced now, I think for the third or fourth time, that they have officially adopted a policy of energy independence from Russia, right? After the previous 20 years of doing the exact opposite. They can announce policies all they want, but the reality is they literally wire Russia $1 billion a day for gas and oil, $1 billion a day, right? That's a lot of money, a significant fraction of Australian GDP. The European powers are just handing over to Russia to continue their lawless war and a genocide against Ukrainian people. Like, shocking. Okay, so counterfactually, Russia invades Ukraine in 2014. Maybe we should do something about that. Okay, well, now they invaded again in 2022. Maybe we don't turn off the last two nuclear power plants. I don't know. Just an idea. Just saying, right? Just as a hypothetical. Also, like, where do all the Chinese companies get their tooling to build all their photovoltaic plants? Right, the factories have tooling, tools and stuff, jigs and so on in the factories that produce these solar modules. They build them themselves, but they also buy them from Germany. Germany is the world's leading producer of factory tooling. So if you were actually like a regional governing power like the EU or even any of the national governments there with like, you know, a modicum of testosterone, you say, huh, we were wrong. Our worldview was wrong. And in fact, it is important for Europe to maintain the ability to have national sovereignty or, you know, local regional sovereignty over its own energy supplies. Incidentally, we did learn this lesson in 1945, but I guess we're going to relearn it now in 2022. And what say we just start writing checks to the major companies in Mittelstand in Germany and in France and any other country that wants to participate, and we're going to take the domestic European solar manufacturing capacity from next to nothing up to as high as we can get it, as quickly as we can get it. And anyone at the time would have said, well, it'll be 2 years before you can even see motion on that front. Okay, fine. But 2 years from then was 2 years ago, right? So like by 2026, Europe could have had complete energy independence and autonomy, but instead they stuck their fingers in their ears and they preferred to pretend that there wasn't a war on their doorstep, they didn't have regional responsibilities, and that if they just ignored it, the problem would go away. Well, it hasn't gone away, right? We've seen more than 1 million people die or be seriously injured in this war in Ukraine, in a continent that's running out of people, that's running out of young people. It's just the stupidest thing I can possibly imagine. It's unbelievable. And these people, they call ourselves our leaders, right? What have they done? What have they done? They've just fiddled while Rome burns. It's absolutely infuriating. It's not even all that hard to, it'd be quite another thing to say, well, we need to build nuclear weapons, nuclear submarines to like keep the Russians at bay. That might be seen as a little bit, you know, inflammatory. But there's nothing inflammatory about doubling the size of a solar plant or doubling the size of a solar battery plant or something like that. It's just like, I don't know. Have you flown around Germany before? I've flown around Germany. Look out the window. What is it? Like zillions of farms, right? You would think that if it was a place that didn't have any solar power, they wouldn't do much farming. But Germany is a massive agricultural exporter, despite the fact that they insist largely for aesthetic reasons in having farms that are operated as though they were in 1900, right? Like, I saw a corn field in Bavaria that was like, I could have jumped across it. So, like, we have cornfields in the United States that are the width of states. It takes you an hour to fly across them.
And your point is that if you can run, a farm obviously needs sunlight because plants need sunlight. So
exactly.
There's sunlight. Yeah. If there's a farm, then there could be a solar array because there's it's obviously not constantly cloudy and dark.
Practically uninhabited deserts. Yeah, like Spain is an incredible place to build solar plants at scale. Italy, Greece, anywhere in Southern Europe is as good as, you know, your median place in the United States.
And so if they'd made that switch, Casey, suppose that they get to the point at which they go, okay, we're going to be completely energy independent and we can transpose this example to the United States and Australia as well. But Europe is a good case because, you know, Hamburg is awful and drizzly and cold and cloudy for most of the year. So that's if they do that, Hamburg. Then what... sorry, Hamburgians. sorry, dude. But like the... Yeah, hamburgers. Frankfurters are nicer. They live in a nicer place, which has less cloud and isn't quite as dark. But suppose that you flick that switch, then what proportion of their energy do you think they can actually get from solar as a continent? Where do you, I mean, obviously you can put it in Spain, but then you have to get it to Hamburg. And what's the rest of the mix?
Right. Prior to industrialization, pretty much 100% of their energy came from solar. Right? Trees, burning wood for fuel and food. Grown in a field, solar power, okay, with a GDP of about $400 per person per year, not a great life. But you say, can Germany, with all its technology and its economic power, not achieve this? Of course it can. I think of the future in 100 years from now, are they still going to be like running around whining about like a high price of natural gas? No, like sooner or later they're going to get there. Like the rate at which solar is being deployed is increasing over time. So like it is just a foregone conclusion that sooner or later they're going to reach the point which they would have if they'd had like a modicum of leadership, like talent.
No, but all I'm asking you from an engineering perspective is like how much of Germany's energy supply can plausibly 100%. Right now using today's technology to supply
100%.
Solar?
Like actually better than that, like 500%. Right? You can grow Germany's economy faster on cheaper energy, on solar and batteries, with today's prices and technology than you can on any other fuel source.
G'day, humans. Well, if you've listened to this much of the episode, then you must enjoy it, presumably, unless you're just listening for masochistic reasons. So you should listen to the rest of it. And the way you do that is by subscribing to the premium feed, where you not only get to hear the rest of this delightful conversation, and trust me, oh, it gets better than what you just heard, but you also get to hear no ads, zero ads. And previously, up until now, you had to go to the old Substack to do that and follow me on Substack and add one more platform to your life if you're not already on Substack. But here's the thing. We are now on Apple Premium Podcast as well. So with one click, Apple will just subscribe you up to the premium feed. You'll be able to listen to the rest of this conversation right now. So open up your Apple Podcasts, click the old Pay Old Zepsy button. That's probably what it's called, Pay Old Zepsy. And you click the button and then you no longer have to be a free rider. You can feel like you're contributing to the mission of this show, which is really what we're all here for. Better conversations, a freer, more freewheeling attitude towards the things that we can talk about, a way to steel man our opponents and to take the most gracious approach towards disagreement. That is what you're voting for when you vote for Uncomfortable Conversations by going into your Apple Podcasts and clicking subscribe. I love you. If you don't do that, that's fine. I'll see you the next free episode, I guess. Take care.